This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
This is Open for Business. I'm Christine Wong. Clear plastic cling wrap might be the cheap and convenient way to keep leftovers, but it actually contributes to larger plastic pollution to the environment, especially when it's not recyclable. With that in mind, Saffron and Sarai has tried to change the cling wrap game by introducing batik beeswax wraps in 2020 at the beginning of the first lockdown. So I have founder Iman Priest of Saffron and Sarai joining me in the studio to unwrap the future of food wrap.
Hi, I like that introduction. Unwrap the future's a good one.
Yes. So I guess we'll start with, how did Saffron and Sarai come about? What was the impetus for starting this?
Yeah. So I've always wanted to have something to call my own, but always with a sustainable aspect to it. So when the first lockdown happened, you know how we always say we don't have time? I had time. We were locked down for 3 months. So then I just started experimenting from there. And basically, I come from an interior design background. So I bring colors, I bring patterns. So the wraps that I had seen were all plain or cutesy or not so nice. So I'm bringing the aesthetic of interior design, but also my personal taste into it, because I like to mix and match patterns and colors and bring culture. Because in interior design, you don't reference Malaysian design, you reference Indian, Balinese, Moroccan, but I never heard Malay. So for me, being half Malay, I wanted that to be an aspect of the business where I will always have batik as part of the range.
Love that. I love that. You sort of started with the design first, but I want to talk a little bit about beeswax wraps. I mean, that concept in and of itself is so unique. How did you find out about that concept, and you know, where did you get the idea from?
So basically, I grew up in the UK, and we've always been conscious about our waste and how much we use and not buying too much. So we use, or my aunt used to use wraps at home that were just plain canvas. But for me, I never felt attracted or interested in it because I just thought it looked like some old cloth. So I wanted to change that perspective, starting with myself, of using a beautiful wrap that you have in the kitchen. So you have a beautiful cushion on your sofa, on your bed, that's part of interior design. So now my approach is to have that in your kitchen, on your countertops, in your fridges, which you don't usually have like a beautiful piece of fabric in. So that's where I'm coming from.
I guess in a way, when we think about food preservation, a lot of it is utility over style, right? You know, your Tupperwares, your cling wrap, whatever it is, it's very plain. You know, it's going to be like transparent, or it's going to be, like you mentioned, if you're using those cloths, not necessarily very visually pleasing. And although, you know, that's maybe not in a way considered necessary by a lot of people, but it does, I think, make the sustainability aspect of it a lot more
approachable.
Yes, that's a fantastic word, you know, and I think it puts a little bit of fun into the process, right, which is always a nice time. Okay, so I want to talk about the production process a little bit. From what I understand, you gather the pieces of batik fabrics, then you soak them in beeswax and jojoba oil, and then you dry them.
And pine resin. Pine resin is one of the key ingredients because it's tree sap and it makes it sticky.
I see. So that's the cling part of the cling wrap.
Yeah.
Interesting. All right. So first of all, I think because we're talking about food preservation here, how do you ensure that these wraps are food safe?
The ingredients that I use are all food certified. So basically, I use beeswax that is meant for cosmetics or food. So I'm not, it has to be triple filtered. It has to be super clean. It has to be only used for food or cosmetics. So then you know it's okay to be in contact with yourself and your food.
And how did you discover the process of creating the wraps in the first place?
YouTube. So I learned a lot on YouTube, in the sense that I learned how to sew on YouTube. I learned how to make things. I came up with my recipe. And there's a lot of tweaking that goes into it, because you can join a class and you can pay for it. But back in the day, well, I mean, even till now, like, you don't want to spend too much on classes and things like that. So I feel like if I can go on YouTube and find something that I can resonate with and that I can learn from, I like the techniques that they're showing, I'm going to try and implement that myself and see if that works for me. And that's basically how I started Saffron. I learned everything from YouTube, and I slowly started to do classes, but more towards like marketing, interior, in Instagram, because those things you really need to understand the back end.
Right.
But with everything else, it was just learning on the go.
I see. You also mentioned that you tweet the recipes that you found on YouTube. How long did it take you to arrive at a production process that you were comfortable with?
A recipe I was comfortable with, I think, took about 6 weeks. The production process took me about a year because you've got to also think of scalability. Like, yes, I am a small homegrown business, but that is not where I want to stop. So when you're starting to supply wholesale or place your items in stores, you've got to consider that you need to make them for, not to say the masses, but a bigger order. So initially I started with 30 pieces, 50 pieces. Then suddenly I got a wholesale order for 200. I was running around thinking, how am I going to do this? But like you just streamline the process and learn how to make more faster. And even till now, I'm still figuring it out as I go along. But it's important to have an SOP so you know it will always be the same. Like if you have too much wax or too little, or you change the ingredients, it affects the outcome.
Yeah, I think especially for a product like this, consistency is key, right?
Yes.
So I also love that you went into this already with the idea and the mindset of, I have to figure out how to make this scalable. I think that is, no, but I think that is an obstacle that a lot of, you know, entrepreneurs who start from home, you know, they start little side hustles here and there. They don't necessarily keep that in mind, right?
Yeah.
And to have that in mind from the get-go is a huge mental advantage, I would say.
I think it's important because you've also got to consider the commission. So when you place it into stores, they're taking 20, 25, 40%. So when it also comes to your price point, you've got to consider your costs. You've got to consider the commission that you're giving to these stores, and then you've got to consider your profitability. Yes, I do it at home, but in the long term, I'm looking at employing staff. I'm looking at renting a place out. So all those factors have to be considered in the price from the very beginning.
And so with that all in mind, I mean, tell me about how you have justified your price points with all that in mind.
So I come from a background where a lot of women in my family are business owners. So my mother, for example, has her own price point when it comes to food. So, but she does it on a scale where you have many, many, many things. So for me, I have to scale it down in terms of price point and increase either the profit margin, because you never know what's going to happen. Like if you're doing a cookie, you can get 50 cents a cookie. Fine, but that's not going to work for me. So in terms of trying to figure it out, it's just my price point. I look at the market as well. I see what it is locally. I see what it is internationally. And I try and find a fair price point, because also the fabrics that I use are not always local or not always affordable. Meaning, let's say you can buy batik for 15 ringgits, but if I really want a nice one, it's going to be 20 to 25 ringgits or more, or 40. So those things I have to consider in the on the grand scheme of things, where I cannot do it per batch. It has to be overall, so that I can play around with, okay, if my profit is less on this batch, the next one can be slightly more to cover my costs.
Essentially, you have to average it all out, right?
Yeah.
And also, I mean, one of the things to consider when setting your price point as well, in comparison to, let's say, like traditional cling wrap, is the fact that these are reusable, right?
Yes.
That's the other element that separates them. So I believe that the idea is that these wraps can last anywhere from 6 months to even a year.
Or longer. Yeah.
So how does that work? And also, what happens at the point where they're no longer able to be reused?
So beeswax wraps are reusable. It's hard to put a number on it, because it depends on how much you use it, how well you look after it. Like if you scrub them when you wash them, if you've left your moldy sandwich in it, you know, all of those things. So it depends on how many times, but they say roughly around 100 to 150 times you can use it. That will usually be about 1 year, but the wraps that I have lasted me for 2 years. So by the end of its lifetime, they're less sticky, and then the wax starts to flake off. You can either compost it, and it's biodegradable because everything is natural, or you can just rewax it. So I also have rewax bars where I've made my mixture, and you just iron it on or put it in the oven to melt it back in. So technically, your wraps never need to be thrown away. And if you consider them compared to cling wrap, which you use a single time, in the long term, you're getting so much use out of this and not harming the environment.
Just out of interest, if someone were to buy the beeswax, I guess, refresher, right? If someone were to get that, would they be able to make their own?
Yes. Yeah.
They would be able to make their own wraps.
Yeah, so if you have a favorite fabric that you like, go for it. If it's Pikachu, go for it. You know, it's like whatever. But the only thing you need to make sure is that it's 100% natural. So either 100% linen or 100% cotton, because it needs to, the wax needs to stick to the fabric. So if you have any plastic based material, it's not going to work.
Interesting, interesting. All right. And you also offer, in addition to the wraps themselves, you also offer a canvas bag as well. Why? And how is that different from the wraps themselves?
So the canvas bag does not have pine resin. And the pine resin is to make it stick to food. But beeswax and jojoba oil are naturally antibacterial, so they prevent your food from getting moldy, but they allow your food to breathe. So with the beeswax bags, if you wanted to keep your fruit and vegetables and your bread fresh for longer, you put it in the bag, stick it in the freezer or the fridge, or even leave it outside, and they will last you for a week or longer. And the breathability of it prevents your vegetables from getting moldy. Because if you leave it in the plastic bag, they start sweating, they get soggy. But if you put them in these bags, they last you for a lot longer.
I cannot begin to tell you how many bags of basil I've just ruined.
Yeah.
You know, but because it sits in the fridge too long and it gets all sad and dark and you know, wet.
Yeah.
And it's really upsetting because I'm just like, I just wanted to make pesto. But, you know, I think taking all these factors into account and also the sustainability factor into account as well is a huge part of what makes Saffron and Sarai wraps so interesting. Now, I also understand that there are options. You have organic beeswax and natural beeswax options. And I think to the layman ear, that sounds like kind of the same thing. What's the difference between that, and why are you offering these options?
So there's a store that I stock in currently, and everything that they have is organic and certified organic, meaning they will check the paperwork of where everything comes from. So to be able to stock in that store, the requirement was that I have all these ingredients certified. So I could only use these ingredients to be available in their stores. So what that means is USDA organic certification and making sure that there is no antibiotics, everything is clean. And the beauty is that you see the difference and you can smell the difference in the organic products and the normal products. So you know that these are happy bees. You know that these, there's nothing inside it, because when I use it, the house smells like licorice. It's amazing. And the normal wax just smells like honey.
Right. And so as a result, I would assume that the organic ones are at a higher price point as well.
Yeah.
Okay.
I try not to make them too different, but it's available there. If somebody lives an organic lifestyle, this is an option for you.
Mm-hmm.
If you're buying organic produce, you want to make sure that the wraps that you're using is organic.
Right. And also, you know, in order to create these products, did you have to have any sort of certification or anything like that, you know, in selling these products as a business as well?
No. All we need is just to have a business registered. To be able to stock in places and join pop-ups, you have to be a registered business. You can't, I mean, for me, what I believe is that you can't just be anybody doing it, because you need to be accountable.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So basically SSM registration.
Okay, fantastic. Well, it's time for a short break, but after that, I will continue speaking to Iman Priest all about Saffron and Sarai and their beeswax wraps here on Open for Business on BFM 89.9.
Burden-free Malaysia. BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
You're listening to Open for Business. I'm Christine Wong, and today joining me in the studio is Iman Priest. She is the founder of Saffron and Sarai, and they offer beeswax wraps, an alternative to plastic cling wrap. Before the break, we talked a little bit about the inception of Saffron and Sarai, as well as how beeswax wraps even work in the first place, and the importance of batik involved as part of a cultural nod to Iman's Malaysian heritage. So I do want to talk a little bit about batik itself now. Where do you actually get the cloths from? I understand that you at least used to use dead stock or remnants. Do you still do that? And where do you source them from now?
No, because the scale that I'm doing it at now, I can't. So any other remnants, I will use it for other things. But I used to buy... So there's two types, where you have printed and then you have hand-stamped. So the printed ones, I just source online or I go to the stores and buy it myself, because a lot of the time you want to touch and feel the fabrics, make sure it's not too thick, make sure it's 100% cotton, make sure that the patterns work with each other. As an interior designer, I'm always like looking and going with my gut instinct. And then the ones that are printed sometimes, not printed, the ones that are hand-stamped, I get from Terengganu sometimes. But because they are all handmade, sometimes in the wax process, the colors can come off. So you have to be careful about the temperature that the fabric is at and the colors, because if it's too, if it's a really light fabric, sometimes with the wax, it goes a lot darker. So also if it's a dark fabric, it goes a lot darker. So there's, you know, there's a lot of experimentation that needs to go into that process as well.
It sounds like it's really involved. Do you still make, hand make all of the beeswax wraps yourself?
Yes.
I mean, tell me about that. That must be...
I just finished production like this week. So sometimes I need to do it every single week, but sometimes I can do it once a month. But I will have all the fabrics cleaned, because when you buy fabrics, there's always a layer of like wax in terms of production. So you need to make sure you can clean and strip the fabric so it's 100% clean and it can absorb the beeswax mixture. So once that's done, then I cut out all the sizes. And then the next thing is to get the beeswax mixture ready and then put it on the fabric.
How sustainable has that been for you in terms of workload?
Oh, it's a headache. It is stressful because you are doing everything. So luckily now, like last year, I had a wholesale project and my brother helped. He's an engineer. So he was like, okay, let's try and do this and do that. So we streamlined the process a bit. But now, so my mom is in the food and beverage industry. So every other week, I kind of borrow her workers or her helpers and then use them. I pay them. And I use them for my production. And then, it makes a lot of difference, because me trying to do that takes about a week. Look, they do it in 2 days.
There's no shame in utilizing the gig economy. You know what I mean? So, I mean, if you have access to people who are able to help, you know, and some pairs of hands, it's always helpful. Would you be, are you currently in the midst of looking for a manufacturer or a manufacturing process that would help you to sort of mass produce a little bit more?
Yes, but I don't know if there is a way to mass produce unless you have the machines. I know in China they'd have these machines that you can do it on a huge scale. I don't know if I'm there yet. I think, yes, I would love to work towards that. But at this point, I'm probably looking for people to help, people who are interested in sustainability and want to get involved. But also if there are people that know of a process that could help, come towards me.
If there's any automation, send it your way, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, since all of your wax wraps are handmade, how do you, I mean, we talked about how consistency is key before the break, right? Yeah. How do you ensure that in that process?
It's about the thickness of the wax. So basically, when you're layering it, you have to strip off the excess, because if there's too much, then it cracks when you use it. So a lot of the time, the girls that I work with are good. They know now what it is that I need. But I'm still checking every single piece to make sure it's not too thick, it's not too thin. So, of course, I would like to streamline that process and have a standard in place. But at this point, I'm still trying to figure out how to do that without using machines.
Right. You're still doing the quality control, essentially.
Yeah.
Right?
But every single piece is checked and I feel it and I know, okay, this has got too much, this has got too little.
So, you know, a lot of raw materials go into these products. You've got the beeswax, you've got the batik wraps, you've got the pine resin, the oils. And I must imagine that at that point that you decided, I'm going to start my own business, I'm going to do this, you had to make an investment.
Yes.
So tell me about the capital that was invested at the beginning of the business as well. How much was that? And also, how did you raise those funds?
So I had savings, a bit of money saved up, because I always try to keep like an emergency fund just for travel, for anything, you know. So I basically used about 3,000 ringgits to start everything up. A lot of it is still for experimentation. So there are ingredients that I couldn't use, so I still have them there. But I think 3,000 ringgits can get you like the ingredients that you need. Or I bought a sewing machine. The sewing machine itself was like 1,200 ringgits. And that's how I made my bags as well. I do it myself. So I learned from YouTube how to sew, and I figure out the patterns myself, sewed it, the recipes, I bought the ingredients, and just experimented as I went along. So I think you can start 3,000 ringgits less, or maybe 5,000 maximum.
And in that time, have you broken even or even become profitable yet?
I don't know, because a lot of the time the money goes back into the business. Mm. I do know my profit margins, but in terms of, because I, when I put money out, I'm not 100% calculating the cost in terms of have I made profit. Mm-hmm. It's in the bank and it's just rolling over.
Right.
In that sense. So mm-hmm. I assume to some extent, you yes, hope. But a lot of it goes back into the business.
Right. So that's not something that you're at the moment focusing on yeah. so much.
Yes.
Okay. Because you're still in that, not quite research and development part of the project yeah. necessarily, but there's still a lot of kinks to be worked out.
Yeah. And it's still getting better because I'm also doing pop-ups in person. Yes. I'm also stocking in different places. So that's also a learning curve. If you choose a stockist that is not right for you, they don't bring in the right kind of people, they don't make sales, you don't get money.
Fantastic that you brought those up, because that's actually my next question. Mm-hmm. Where you do have stockists, you don't have your own store mm-hmm. brick and mortar base necessarily, yes. but you have almost 10 locations, I believe, that you work with. You've got Shop Unplug in Bangsar, Remedy yeah. at Jalan Rotan, Ilham Gallery Gift Shop. You know, you've got the Just Life Shops, which also have multiple yes. locations as well. So tell me about creating those relationships and making sure that you've picked the right stockists as well.
So at the beginning, when you're new and you're a startup, anything that comes your way, you get excited. You're like, oh my God, they really like my stuff. They want my stuff. But then there are a few times when there's no sales or they only made one sale. It's not good enough for me because I can't keep that. They're holding my stock. And they've also got to have a client base that understands sustainability, understands eco-friendly products, that will also understand the price point. Yes, you can buy cling film, but cling film is going to be this price and a beeswax wrap is going to last you 1, 2, 3 years, but it's going to be this price. So if you're using it at a price, you know, if you divide it over the uses,
it's an investment.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that's the first step in terms of figuring out the right stockist for you. So I always try and do my research. When someone reaches out to me, I do my research in terms of, are they suitable for me and my brand? Because I also have to make sure that they're good for me.
Mm. And the fact of the matter is, you also started this at the beginning of the pandemic, yes. right? So, you know, going to pop-ups and yes. all that stuff was not an no. option at the time. Yeah. And I would imagine that also the stockists are something not new, but newer in mm-hmm. the process, because a lot of shops were just closed
yeah.
throughout the pandemic. I mean, talk to me about how that has affected your strategy when it comes to the business.
Yeah. So at the beginning, a lot of it was on Instagram and the website. So yeah. I built the website myself. So basically, a lot of my Instagram traffic I would put towards the website and I was getting sales from there. And I guess at the beginning of the pandemic, for the first 2 years, no in-person contact.
Yeah.
So then this just last year, towards the end of last year and this year, it started to get better. So my 2022 resolution was, let's just join one pop-up, because personally, you might not realize it, I'm an introvert and I get really nervous around people, and I'm getting better with time. But that is also part of the process of running a business, where you just learn how to talk about the business. You learn how to have the answers ready, you know?
Yeah.
So in terms of joining a pop-up, for me, that was super scary. So I said, just join one per year.
Mm.
And so far, I think I've joined about 5. So I think it's helping, in the sense that you got to choose also the right events. You know, you can't choose an event that's not suitable for your brand either. Yeah.
I think it's really interesting. I've spoken to quite a number of people who started, I guess, from a more design background and mm-hmm. then turned that into a business like yeah. you. And a lot of them also have talked about how pop-ups and bazaars have sort of allowed them to come out of their shell.
Yeah.
And that, in addition to the fact that I think, especially, you know, coming from the arts perspective, you don't really expect extroversion to be part of the deal, right?
Yes.
I mean, as an interior designer, you have to talk to clients, yeah. you have to do all that, but it's very relegated to, okay, we'll talk about the design yeah. and we have this to focus on. You have to be an advocate for yourself exactly. and your own business in this yeah. case. So it really has to push you out of your comfort zone,
sure,
right?
Sure. And the beauty of it is that because it's your baby, you have all the answers.
Yes.
You know what to talk about. But if you're going into a social setting, you don't know anybody, where do you start?
Mm.
So I think an element of introversion doesn't come into play as much when it comes to your own business, because you know what you want to talk about.
Yeah.
You know what you're trying to tell them.
Yeah. It's also a fantastic way to get, you know, some insight into what your consumers mm-hmm. are curious about, or what mm-hmm. they might need, or what you could expand with in the future as well.
Oh, you're asking me?
Yeah.
I'm still looking at in terms of what I want to expand into, But I think the beeswax wraps are my main thing. So it's also trying to make it more interesting to people that don't want batik or they don't want patterns.
Right.
So I'm starting to look at things that are more plain but colored. Blocked based.
Right.
So those are things that I'm, because my beeswax wraps are always going to be there and the batik is always going to be there. So it's also trying to spread out in terms of, I used to have sets available, so a set of four, a set of two, but now I'm having them available individually because sometimes people aren't ready to commit to a whole set. Mm. They just want to try it out. So those are aspects of the business that I'm also considering, because whenever I did pop-ups, I could sense that there's hesitation when you're asking them to spend the amount, you know, for one set.
Right.
So if I break it down and have it available as one piece, they're okay.
Mm.
And so far, it's been doing good.
Yeah, and I think essentially you also have to diversify your designs as well, just
yes.
because although batik is lovely, mm-hmm. it's not necessarily up everyone's aesthetic
exactly.
alley, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that's another interesting thing. It's essentially as if you are, you know, like a fashion designer, but mm-hmm. this is the basics collection, right?
Yes.
This is
the
slightly more utilitarian,
correct.
But, you know, still rooted in yes. that design element,
yeah.
for sure.
Because you do have people that are minimalists and they want a clean wrap.
Mm.
You know, simple colors, simple patterns, you know, so that's something that I also want to consider and take on board as well.
I think also I want to ask you a little bit about some work that you do with mm-hmm. immigrants and refugees mm-hmm. here as well. Talk to me about that and why that's important to you.
I enjoy utilizing skill sets that are there. So basically, like the seamstresses that I use, either they're part of a refugee organization or I go into, I don't know if you've heard of Gomba.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lower income area. So you do get a lot of people that are not working every day, especially during the pandemic. My mom couldn't use her helpers every single day of the week. So I was taking them. That's how it started.
Ah.
I was asking them to help me out because they didn't have any work. So for me, it's like, if I can help out, even though it's so random, like they've never done beeswax wraps. They're like, what is this for? But I'm teaching them a skill set that, you know, is different. And I'm also educating them on sustainability. And so now anytime they cut my fabrics, they don't throw anything away.
Mm.
Any beeswax that is not used, because you can use everything, you can turn it into compost in the long term. So they don't throw anything away. So basically, I just think it's important to not just stay within your circle, but like also branch out and reach out to different people.
Yeah, 100%. So I guess final question is, what are the goals for Saffron and Serai mm-hmm. for the future?
The goals would be to become one of Malaysia's main beeswax wrap suppliers or makers, bring the Malaysian culture abroad. You know, people. I want people to know more about batik and sustainability and Malaysia standing for that. So that's important to me.
Mm.
But if anybody ever needs to ask me about beeswax wraps or anything, they should just contact me on Instagram because I manage the Instagram page.
And your handle would be?
At Saffron and Serai.
Okay, mm-hmm. amazing. All right. Well, that is about it for today's conversation. But thank you to Iman for sharing your story about Saffron and Serai. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank
lovely.
You so much.
All right. You've been listening to Open for Business. I'm Christine Wong. I've been speaking to Iman Priest, founder of Saffron and Serai, about her beeswax wraps. If you've missed any of today's conversation, you can, of course, download our app. It's available on both the Apple App Store and Google Play. You can also head over to our website, bfm.my, to listen back to our podcast and more. This is BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.